This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas, presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Melissa Idris, and this is The Breakfast Grill. Our guest this morning, Terence Gomez, Professor of Political Economy at University of Malaya. Thank you so much for joining us, Terence. You've been a regular voice in the media on the, as the sort of the run-up to the polls for GE14. You were doing your analysis. I want to begin by asking you, were you surprised by the results? I mean, they've been telegraphed as a shock result, but were you shocked?
Yes, I was extremely shocked. I visited all the states in the peninsula during the campaign period, and what came across to me as I visited the parties on the ground was a clear indication of two dysfunctional coalitions. In both coalitions, we could see that the parties were in disarray. In UMNO, there was serious factionalism, which was undermining the party. MCA and Gerakan didn't seem to look like they were a party which had its game together. But in the opposition, too, there were serious problems. We could see a lot of infighting between the parties, and we could also see there were problems within the parties. So I was not expecting this result.
So apart from factionalism, what else were you looking out for? Because, you know, you did write about your experiences during the campaign trail in the different states. So apart from seeing all these fractures, what else were you looking out for?
Well, I was looking at the political machinery. I wanted to see the party machinery. How effective was that party machinery in mobilizing people? In that sense, too, I was a bit surprised because I felt the opposition's machinery was weak, especially in the northern parts of the peninsula. I would argue that even in UMNO, they seemed to be rather fractured, which was undermining their machinery too.
So what do you think, what accounts then for these results? And maybe, you know, because you are an academic and I know you that nuance is very important, so maybe you can give us a nuanced sense of what's happened with these results.
Well, there are a couple of things. One issue which came out from our work on the ground was that there appeared to be a pact, an alliance between PAS and the Barisan Nasional, in particular UMNO. And there seemed to be a strategy between the leaders of these two parties in terms of how to mount a campaign where both parties would win. And it came across to me as the plan was for UMNO to take the parliamentary seats and PAS would take the states, in particular Kedah, Kelantan and Terengganu. That pact did not work out in favour of the Barisan Nasional. It seems to have favoured PAS. So what this means is that the electorate didn't take the cue from the politicians in terms of their political strategies to win the election. So here, the second thing that came across was this. How was the electorate also responding? Here we found, again, serious divisions. In the urban areas, there was clear support for the opposition. But in the rural areas, we couldn't tell. It was a very muted campaign. And when we were talking to politicians, especially the opposition, people would come and tap them on the back and say, look, we carry the BN poster in our cars and in our homes, but we're going to vote for you. But they said this very quietly. So there was this sort of silent thing that was going on, which seemed to suggest that something was going on the ground. But the reason why I did not expect this was because the political machinery of the opposition was so weak. I expected them to do well in the urban areas, but I definitely didn't expect this in the rural areas.
So does this mean the assumption that you need a good, strong machinery to carry you through is erroneous? That in fact, you don't need it. As long as you have a mass, a mood, a wave, that is sufficient to accomplish the task?
No, it's not so simple, Sharon. Because if you look at the votes in the rural areas, that's where the real battle was because of the gerrymandering. If you look at the voting patterns, according to Madeka's recent findings, the votes indicate that there was a split. 40% for the Barisan Nasional, 30% for PAS, and 30% for Pakatan. So what happened was the way the people voted tended to favor the opposition. So that's how you should look at it. It is not like there was a massive swing across the board in the Malaya heartland towards the opposition. There was a swing, yes, 60% of the vote went. But remember, the votes were still split between PAS and Pakatan. And this could have favoured the Barisan Nasional.
So, Terence, what does it mean to you that the you know, the methods of the previous elections, you know, the gift giving, the handouts, the patronage, that doesn't work anymore. What does it tell you about what we're looking at in terms of a new era of Malaysian politics?
We did see that in this campaign. We saw it covertly. We saw it in a very overt manner too. In terms of covertly, when we talked to UMNO people, they did acknowledge that handouts had to be given. They did admit to us that they had to practice a certain amount of patronage mm-hmm. to get the support of the party behind a discredited leader. And they needed to do that because the party machinery had to be united against a very strong opposition. So that patronage did happen.
Yeah, speaking of discredited leaders, how toxic was Ran Najib to UMNO and Barisan Nasional? And if he's out of the picture, do you see Barisan Nasional essentially recover the ground it's lost?
The problem for UMNO, if you ask me, was Najib. They didn't do anything about Najib when they had the chance to do so. If they had removed Najib from the equation, I think the Barisan Nasional would have fared better, especially in the rural areas. If you look at the campaign, too, between PAS and Barisan, and I'm leaving out Pakatan because they didn't really have much of a campaign in the north. If you look at the campaign there, there was a tacit agreement not to attack each other.
So between Barisan and PAS?
Yes, UMNO and PAS. So you will see in that campaign, interestingly enough, compared to 2013, as you raised, Melissa, I went to the ground, too, during the 2013 election. What shook me about 2018 was there was hardly any mention about the wrongdoings of the Prime Minister. And there was hardly any mention about Hadi, too, on the other side. In fact, both of them had a very silent campaign about each other. But they had a common enemy. In the case of UMNO, they went on and on about Mahathir. In the case of PAS, they were denigrating Amanah, calling them traitors. So the enemies were different, and the focus was on that. But I think this did not go down well with the electorate because PAS took what they called was a soft approach. Don't attack Najib. It's not good. It's not our Malay culture. But I said, but you are attacking Mahathir. And look at what you're saying about Amanah. You're calling them traitors, Pengkhianat, and so on and so forth. So it was a tactical move. But that move didn't seem to have favoured, as I said, the Barisan Nasional.
So now that Najib Razak is out of the picture and we're assuming that he will be charged and maybe out of politics for some time, do you think that UMNO can recover the lost ground? I mean, because I know it's a bit premature. We just had GE14. I'm looking to GE15 and the possibilities that in the intervening years that despite what people say about them needing to rebrand and rethink and all that, that essentially they can keep to the model they have and gain some strength?
Again, Sharad, I don't think it's that simple. One of the things that came across in this election was the electorate was sending a message, which they had said in the past too, no more race-based politics. In fact, it's interesting that Khairi himself said, we are going to change and we're not going to be a Malay-based party. We should consider becoming a Malaysian-based party. That would be a major structural change. And that can be good for the nation. But will the people in the party, will the members accept that kind of shift away from Malay politics to a more Malaysian-type politics?
Yeah, it requires a shift in mindset, right? And, you know, a party with such strong legacy. But I do want to point out, you know, if we are moving away from race-based politics, doesn't this success of PAS in the previous election show that we're perhaps headed to religion-based politics?
Yes, that is something to be concerned about. But let's look at the results carefully. PAS, as I said earlier, won because the pact that they had with Barisan worked in their favour. That is the point. If you look at all previous elections, whenever PAS did well, they were in coalition with other opposition parties. And other opposition parties helped PAS win. This is the first time that PAS has gone it alone and did very well. So I wouldn't pay too much attention to that point that you just raised, Melissa. Now, the second point I want to say, when we went to Terengganu and when we spoke to the PAS members there, they said, Islam is not something we are going to push. So I said, so what are you pushing in as your key agenda? They said, development.
In Terengganu.
And they said, and I said, how is that going to manifest itself? He said, look at our manifesto. We are changing our dialogue from Islam to what we call a technocratic government. By that they meant we are going to bring in a lot of professionals and put them in government, and they will then bring about this technocratic form of governance that they wanted to institute. This is a very important point, because they also kept Hadi out of the state elections. Hadi didn't run because they were fearful if Hadi came in and if Hadi became Menteri Besar, we will see the governance that we saw between 1999 and 2004. Mm. And that's what Terengganu people just didn't want.
No, so aspirations aside, the question of capacity, as you just noted, they held Terengganu for one term, they lost it under Hadi, then they held Kedah for one term and lost it. In both instances, poor leadership at the top was the stated reason for that. Do you think they can turn this around at this point in time? They'll be able to address the concerns that people in Kelantan have, and as well as Terengganu?
Definitely in Terengganu. Terengganu and Kelantan are two different types of politics, although it's the same party. Terengganu, they do have now technocrats in government. Look at the new Menteri Besar of Terengganu, Dr. Sam. He is a PhD in aeronautical science. He is someone who thinks like a technocrat, not like a politician. I met him, I spoke to him. And the first thing that hit me is he's not like the type of UMNO members you would normally meet.
Not the usual.
Not, definitely not the type like Hadi or Nikazis. Kelantan is a different type of politics. And they made the point to me, Nik Aziz was a Tok Guru, but he was also a very astute politician. In the case of Hadi, he was a Tok Guru, but he was not an astute politician.
But you say he's not astute, but he has led his party, interestingly enough, into a very productive strategy, right? So he left Pakatan Rakyat, said he would go alone, said that they would become kingmakers, and they almost became kingmakers in Perak and Kedah. What do you think their narrative is going to be coming out of these results?
You see, Sharad, let's make a distinction between what the politicians planned and the outcome. The way the people voted was not the way, I would argue, Hadi and Najib expected. Nobody expected this kind of trends in the elections. What was Hadi also doing? He put 158 parliamentarians candidates to run in the parliamentary seats. And I forgot the number of state seats that he put past candidates in. And I remember asking them too, why are you doing this? You're not going to win. And where is all the money coming from to fund all these people? So there are a lot of things which are happening on the ground in terms of strategies that were employed by politicians, but did not necessarily pan out the way they expected.
Did you answer your question, where the money is coming from?
Well, they told me that, you know, when they pass the hat around, they get a lot of money. But interestingly, in this campaign, I didn't see them passing the hat around during the charamas. In fact, I didn't see that many big charamas. So a question was raised in my mind about political financing. That's a big issue. We have to discuss this.
I think one of their leaders said PAS has deep pockets. I think that was the expression he used, and it was reported in, I think Takiuddin said that.
Takiuddin said it.
Yeah. We're speaking to Terence Gomez, Professor of Political Economy at University of Malaya. We'll be back with a deeper look at the results of GE14. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning, and you just joined us. This is The Breakfast Grill. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Melissa Idris, and our guest this morning, Terence Gomez, Professor of Political Economy at University of Malaya, and of course, author of many books, including books looking at the relationship between the political establishment and corporate Malaysia, and also a most recent book on the Ministry of Finance, Inc. And, Melissa, I believe that you, in fact, interviewed Terence on this book on The Breakfast Grill some months ago.
Well, I'm actually holding the book right now, Minister of Finance, Incorporated, Ownership and Control of Corporate Malaysia. And a large part of this book, Terence, is to do with the concentration of power of MOF Inc. in the office of the executive, which we want to talk about because in the new cabinet lineup, it's been separated. So Pakatan Harapan has focused on the manifesto promise of separating those two portfolios of the prime ministership and the Minister of Finance ship.
What do you make, Terence? You heard Tun Dr. Mahathir come back, you know, take that when he took that position as the Prime Minister. What have you been reading? It's been an extraordinary week and a bit. Your first thoughts about the return of Dr. Mahathir to the leadership of the country?
Well, having covered Malaysian politics since the 1990s, my first book was Politics and Business, UMNO's Corporate Investments, where I looked at Mahathir's policies and that of Dime Zainuddin too. I must say I had some concerns. But I think Mahathir has gone through what one would call a rehabilitation process, having spent 2 years at least in the opposition, he personally experienced the consequences of that concentration of power in the office of the executive. He now saw the impact it was having not only on society but on the economy as a whole. I would argue that when he came to power now, he realized the reforms were necessary. Now, the first two things Mahathir said is very important. He said, I'm going to deal with two things, political financing and the GLCs. These are important points because for political financing, he was worried about one important issue, state capture. When you move from a process of authoritarian rule to democracy, what will happen is powerful business elites in particular will try and capture control of the states by funding the politicians. That's why he said, let's have disclosure. That's an important point to ensure the independence of the state when they try to govern in the post-authoritarian period. The second issue, he said, was the GLCs. What that means is there's significant concentration of power in the office of the finance minister. And he would want to do something about devolving that power. But I just want to make one more point. The GLCs raise another important point. The model of development. Should it be interventionist, which it is with the GLCs, or should it be more market-driven, neoliberal type, which means privatization?
Let's take those two points, right? So we'll start with the political financing, then we'll go into the GLCs. If we were to look at political financing, Terence, in terms of, you know, donations to parties, anonymous donations to parties, is that something we will no longer be seeing in this new Pakatan Harapan government?
After the crisis of 1MDB and later the 2.6 billion ringgit that flowed into the Prime Minister's account, a big debate began again about political financing. We prepared a list of recommendations for the reform of political financing, and we sent it to Najib, and he was supposed to table it in Parliament. He formed his own cabinet committee to do it, and they too came up with their recommendations. I can tell you now, the recommendations are ready. They just have to institute it, and they are obliged to do it because it's in their manifesto. They put it in their manifesto because we pressed them on it. Barisan Nasional too said they're going to do it.
Can you share some of the reforms?
Well, the reforms, interestingly enough, are, first of all, disclosure. We want to know who's funding our parties. We just spoke about it just now. Where was PAS getting all their money from? Mm-hmm. There was no disclosure there. Where was UMNO getting all that money from too? They spent a lot of money in the election. And for that matter, where too did the opposition get their money from? They too had to mount a campaign. We have no clue where all this money came from. So disclosure is one important thing. The second important thing is to put a cap on expenditure and income. And the third important thing is institutional reform. Institutional reforms to so that we can check when money flows into the party, there is accountability on the parts of the parties to disclose where the money is coming.
So when you say a cap on income and donations, is that for spending during election period, is it?
There is definitely during the spending period, and we have laws on that too. The Election Offences Act covers that. But there's also the issue of throughout the year. I am concerned not so much also about the money going into the hands of the parties, but also into the hands of politicians. Politicians also can be caught, captured. Mm. And we want politicians also. That's why the declaration of assets is a very important issue, which was also put on the table, so that we know where the money is coming from if they suddenly become overly rich.
You know, Terence, before we get into the kind of nitty-gritty of institutional reform and all these other things on the agenda, the question the assertion that you made earlier, which is that we are moving from an authoritarian to a democrat, potentially a democratic state, and that we are in a position, period of transition. And I think a lot of people don't recognize that. They don't recognize this moment as a moment of transition. And academics like yourself and others look at these transitions. We had transitions from one-party states around the world, the fall of the communist regimes in Europe, for instance. We've had decades of a fusion between state and party. That's not going to be easy to dismantle, is it? I mean, could you help us understand what are the real challenges in this transition?
We don't have to go to Europe to look for lessons. Just look at Asia. Look at the Philippines after 1986. Look at Indonesia in the late 1990s. The period of transition from authoritarian rule to democracy is always, always characterized by chaos, instability. But in those two cases, what we have also seen was there was a people's power revolution. We had a people's power revolution of a different sort. It was through the electoral box. And in that sense, we are better off. But the change, this point of transition will definitely we will be encountering a lot of problems. We must be prepared for those problems.
What about the possibility of reversals? We saw reversals in the Philippines and potentially even, depending how you look at the Indonesian situation, reversals there.
How quickly were the reversals, though?
Well, in the case of the Philippines, quite soon. I mean, there was the Mandiola massacre of farmers, I think just less than a year into this.
Very quickly.
And the return to the families controlling the Philippines, right? So, I mean, could we have a reversal? I mean, lots of money is at stake in this transformation, isn't it?
That's a very good point, Sharad. That's why the point was made about political financing, state capture. When you move to a democratic period, elites in the private sector in particular become very powerful, and they did make an attempt to capture control of the state, and you saw that in the Philippines, you yourself raised it. That is what we want to guard against. So here, during this transition, you asked me, should we be worried about recent changes? Yes. We should be worried about changes because, look, one of the first things that began to happen after the elections was party hopping. Mm. Now, I'm not happy with this party hopping. I can understand why they may be doing it because they want to get a two-thirds majority to bring about some of the reforms they want to institute, which means you have to amend the constitution, you need a two-thirds majority. But party hopping and who's hopping over into the party and who are you having alliances with? That's not a very good thing. So there are these issues also of political continuity. By that I mean, if you look at the current administration, many of the people were of the administration of the 1990s, Mahathir, Anwar, and Daim. So we want to have a break from that past, but the same actors are still in place. There is one difference. They are now working in a coalition where they are not hegemonic. There is checks and balances within this coalition. So there are a lot of good trends too. Mahathir cannot do the things that he used to do while he was in UMNO. But those issues suggest why we in civil society must be very, very vigilant during this period. Keep the politicians in check.
Yeah, so, you know, if you were to use that kind of comparison between Mahathir in his first tenure as Prime Minister, business and politics were so interlinked with, say, Najib's administration. Are we likely to see repeats of what happened with Mahathir's administration the first time around?
Mahathir's administration was characterized by what we would call crony capitalism, a close nexus between politics and business. Najib's administration was characterized by what we would call a kleptocracy, a personalization of that wealth. Mahathir's policies was developmental to some extent. He did create a new breed of dynamic businessmen, although through a form of crony capitalism. We don't have to do all those things anymore.
How can we safeguard against crony capitalism?
This is where the issue about disclosure and transparency in governance becomes important. This is where the issue of institutional reforms become important.
But how can they do it, and will they have the political will? If the very base the material base of these political parties are in support from these crony capitalists and so on and so forth. I mean, it's, you know, they're basically undermining their own selves in some ways, isn't it? Is that what you're asking them to do?
And that is why, as I said, when Mahathir said, let's reform political financing, I said, this man has got the right mindset in terms of how to bring about the reforms. That is something you have to check immediately. We had concerns about this even among the opposition parties in Penang and in Selangor. We spoke to them about that too. And there was a reluctance on the part of opposition parties in the run-up to 2018 even to bring about political financing in terms of disclosure. That is why we have to change that immediately. Mahathir is on the right track.
We're speaking to Terence Gomez, Professor of Political Economy at University of Malaya. We'll be back with more. Don't go away. We have the bulletin coming up and then the Breakfast Grill continues. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning and welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. If you just joined us, our guest this morning is Terence Gomez, Professor of Political Economy at University of Malaya. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Melissa Idris. Terence, we were talking about the early days of the new Pakatan government. They've announced a committee for institutional reform. What is it? What do you think they did that as one of the first moves they made?
One of the features of the Barisan National Government, especially from the 1980s, was the extreme concentration of power in the office of the Prime Minister, the executive. This was Mahathir's doing too. And we can go back, the defining moment was really 1987. And after the 1987 crackdown on the media and then the judiciary, you can see now what is happening. And then Mahathir also then became the Minister of Finance. So all these issues indicate significant power in the office of the Prime Minister. The institutional reforms that Mahathir is instituting now clearly seems to indicate that he wants to undo those things that he had done. But what is also interesting about Mahathir, he's taking it out from the hands of the parties and he's forming independent committees. And these independent committees comprise some very prominent people, including previous critics of the state, highly intelligent and competent. They know what to do. So in that sense, I think, again, Mahathir has been acting appropriately by passing this responsibility to bring about the reforms. He won't do it, but he's giving it to people who know exactly how to do it. So we can expect some good changes to be put in place.
And you're seeing the political will to get this done? And this is not just election promise talk?
To be fair, it was in their manifesto. Mm-hmm. Pakatan said it. And I would argue that most people voted for Pakatan too because of that manifesto.
One of the things you mentioned about institutional reform was not just looking at political financing. The other arm of that was the look at the GLCs, right? What kind of reforms do you think need to be done with the GLCs?
Now, that's an important question, Melissa, because there are two models of development, broadly speaking. One is the state interventionist form. That means a lot of government presence in the economy. And the other is the more market-driven, free market type, the neoliberal form, if you call it, where there's little government intervention. The big debate about the GLC is this: should it be interventionist or should it be neoliberal? By that I mean privatization. This is a debate that will go on in government about not just whether to privatize or not, but what should be the role of the state in the economy. That is a big debate. And I think there will be differences of opinion among the people in cabinet too, as well as among the reform committees, as to how the government should function.
How does this impact the man on the street? I mean, the balance of strategies in terms of privatization and market driven imperatives as opposed to state design. At the end of the day, what people get in terms of wages, and we've talked a lot about not just the rising cost of living, but the suppression of wages for the longest time. I mean, how does it impact the man on the street?
It does impact the man on the street in a big way because the GLCs are in almost every sector of the economy. Utilities, healthcare, education, even construction, media. And let's not forget banking. All this affects the man on the street. And you can't just simply go and privatize all these things. And who are you going to privatize to? If we just simply privatize all these things, we are taking powerful institutions and putting it in the hands of a new business elite, which we will create. It will also contribute to greater wealth concentration, which will have a big impact on the Gini coefficient. This country already has a problem with wealth disparities in this country. So let's be very clear. If you do not get this right, there can be serious repercussions on the economy. So the government has to think this through very carefully in terms of how they're going to reform the GLCs. Here again, I credit Mahathir. He said it. The first two things he said was political financing and the GLCs. Broadly speaking, now you can see now what were the implications of all these two things, which he narrowed down in very simple terms, like he normally does, to two issues. That is the debate that now this country must have. That's why I said be prepared for a lot of conversations on these issues.
Well, you know, as you alluded to earlier as well, in times of transition of government, there can be uncertainty and instability, right? And that's all part and parcel of us growing as a democracy. How do we get the people used to this uncertainty in this time period, especially given the fact that, you know, as a public, we're used to having this high level of stability?
That's why talk shows like this are important.
Oh, thank you.
I would argue, look, do not be afraid. Look at other countries. Sharad said it. Look at other countries too. They went through this process. This is normal. What we wanted was the end of authoritarian rule. We wanted a more democratic system. We are going to get it. But as we move in that direction, be prepared that there will be problems, teething problems. But I have full faith in Malaysians that we will sort it out. There are a lot of very competent people out there who are helping institute these reforms. So do not be afraid.
Well, what about the level of difficulty, especially with something like the GLCs? They're part of the architecture of state now. Are you looking at potentially dismantling GLCs, and which would need to go first?
I'm not looking to dismantling the GLCs. I'm looking towards proper governance, accountable governance. I'm looking in terms of studying the GLCs, how to improve their productivity. Whatever you may say about the GLCs, they are accountable to the people because they are owned by the government. We can hold them accountable. To be fair to Abdullah, Abdullah brought about some reforms of the GLCs, and the GLCs are well functioning. They are among the top 10 companies, and they've been there for the past 20 years. You can't be a top 20 publicly listed company if you are not a well-functioning company. What we have to do is we have to ensure that checks and balances in the governance system. So by that, I mean the professionals who are brought in must be truly competent to lead it, and these professionals and the board of directors should be chosen based on merit, and they must be made accountable not so much to the Minister of Finance, but I would argue to a select committee within Parliament comprising also members of the current opposition. So there is a real open dialogue in terms of how the GLCs are being managed.
Yeah, I'm hoping to see perhaps a lot more divestment of government from business, simply, you know, because that was the promise previously, right, to reduce government involvement in business. But I'm also wondering, because Mahathir was a big proponent of big businesses, that was his time was about big businesses, whether his idea of perhaps looking at privatization going forward is something we're going to be seeing a lot more of. That's something we've been hearing talked about in the media in the past few days.
When we talk about divestments of GLCs, let's go sector by sector and company by company. You cannot go and divest the utilities, for example. And please be careful about what you're going to do with the banks. You don't want to just relinquish control of these major banks, Maybank, CIMB, into private hands. But if you want to talk about divestments of, say, the companies in the construction sector, I'll say go ahead. Go ahead. You don't need, the government doesn't need to be involved in this kind of construction-based firms. So let's do it systematically and carefully. And let's look at what should serve the interest of the people first when we talk about how we're going to divest. And let's also, as I said, not go and create a new kind of business elite where much wealth is concentrated. That is also not good for the nation.
Terence, are you confident that the cabinet, we've only seen a couple of names so far announced, but we're seeing that they will act in a way that is beyond their kind of immediate political interest? Because they are going to be people in cabinet who are there because they are, you know, representatives of their party, or they are part of the coalition. That will be people coming from Warisan, for instance, who might actually be part of the old system, not necessarily new faces with new ideas. This cabinet is going to be a bit of a mixed bag, don't you think, in terms of competence and credibility?
Mahathir did say that when he looked at the elected representatives, the problem here is that many of them have never been in government before.
Right.
He did allude to the fact there will be a serious lack of experience in terms of governance at the federal level. So in that sense, Sharad, I'm not looking too much to the cabinet. I'm looking to the committees that he has formed. Those committees, as I said earlier, comprise some very prominent, eminent people and experts in their respective fields.
But the politicians, the politicians will have to eventually sign off on these.
Yeah, and
they could be a bottleneck, couldn't they?
The council is only for 100 days, if I'm not mistaken. Is it more than that?
They do say it's for 100 days, but given the volume of work involved in reforms, it's going to take more than 100 days. But we'll leave that to Mahathir to decide. But you're right, Sharad. Ultimately, it goes back to the cabinet. And the cabinet has to make the final decision. And that's when we will be looking to the cabinet. Because I expect the institutional reforms that will be forwarded to them to be of the sort that will be in the interest of the nation. If the cabinet does not accept these reforms, that's where we have to be vigilant of the cabinet too. If it serves their party interests, we have to watch to see how they take these reforms and what are they going to institute.
You know, some of your students or ex-students have been tweeting in saying, you know, shout out to you. They're listening to you. And I think remembering Sharifa Nurul Alwal is one of the many who've actually tweeted in saying you used to be her a lecturer. and you've given us a very good insight into what needs to be done. I don't know if this is something that you welcome, but I'm looking forward to you being on one of those select committees in order to guide the way this new government in transition operates.
Keep them in check, right, to Professor Terence?
Yeah. We've been speaking to Terence Gomez, Professor of Political Economy at University of Malaya, and we'll keep this conversation going. I'm hoping that we can bring you back on a more regular basis.
Back.
Thank you so much for being with us this morning. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Melissa Idris. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.